Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Iraq's military begins an offensive to retake a prominent city, and Russia says Ukraine would negotiate better without U.S. assistance. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. The Iraqi army has launched what it calls a major offensive to retake the northern city of Tikrit from Sunni extremists. Military officials say the main ground operation began today with heavy fighting in the city between Sunni rebels and Iraqi special forces. Iraqi helicopter gunships also fired on the area to repel the rebels as Iraqi tanks rumbled from the south to attack. Casualties so far are unclear. Meanwhile, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant militant group continues to score victories across the countries. For neighbor Turkey, there is growing concern about ISIL's power, particularly in its predominantly Kurdish southeast, which borders Iraq and Syria. Dorian Jones reports for VOA.
ISIL is attracting a growing number of recruits, according to Muammer Akar, a Diyarbakir city councillor and prominent member of Turkey's ruling AK party. Saudi Arabia has spent much money here developing a radical form of Sunni Islam called Wahhabism to counter Iran's influence. Many Kurdish youths were attracted and have become increasingly radical and closer to committing violence. Akar claims the funerals in the region for ISIL militants draw large numbers and have become a powerful recruiting tool for the Islamic group. But critics are accusing the ruling AK party, which has its roots in Islam, of turning a blind eye to ISIL's activities on Turkey's border with Syria because of the party's opposition to the Syrian regime. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Diyarbakir, southeast Turkey.
A car bomb has exploded in a rebel-held Damascus suburb, killing at least two people. Witnesses and activists say the blast hit a busy market in Douma, and the total number of casualties are unclear at this time. Several wounded in the blast are getting treatment at a hospital. No one has claimed responsibility for the blast. The suspected leader of the deadly attack 2 years ago on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya, has arrived in the United States. The U.S. Attorney's Office said today that Libyan militant Ahmed Abu Khatala is in U.S. law enforcement custody. Authorities are declining to give further details. Officials say they intend to prosecute Khatala in a federal court in Washington, D.C. U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans died in the September 11, 2012 attack. Russia's foreign minister is accusing the United States of encouraging Ukraine to challenge Russia. Sergei Lavrov, speaking on television today, said our American colleagues still prefer to push the Ukrainian leadership toward a confrontational path, and the chances for settling the Ukrainian crisis would be better if the negotiations depended only on Russia and its European partners. Ukraine has signed an agreement with the European Union on Friday, solidifying the nation's resolve to turn west, away from neighboring Russia. From Kiev, VOA's Anita Powell reports on how this agreement will change things.
Ukraine's new president, Petro Poroshenko, said this historic association agreement with the European Union is the second most important thing that has happened to his Eastern European nation. The first, he said, was independence, which Ukraine gained when the former Soviet Union broke apart in 1991. He signed the EU pact Friday morning in Brussels. Ukraine's drift toward Europe is what sparked the latest bout with Russia this year, beginning in February when Ukrainians overthrew their pro-Russian president after he refused to sign an EU agreement. Since then, Ukraine has accused Russia of funding rebels in eastern Ukraine, where fighting has raged for months. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kiev.
Officials in northeastern Nigeria say an explosion at a small hotel has killed 10 and injured another 14. There has been no claim of responsibility for the blast late Friday in the outskirts of the city of Bauchi. The French news agency says the building was widely known to be a brothel, making it a likely target of the Boko Haram. And the World Cup's coveted round of 16 begins play today, with Brazil taking on Chile and Colombia facing off with Uruguay, which is without its star player Luis Suarez. Suarez banned from playing because of a biting incident. The Italian player bitten by Suarez said earlier this week that the governing body for international football went too far, banning Suarez from 9 international matches and from participating in football-related activities for 4 months. Suarez, meantime, greeted supporters from the balcony of his home in Uruguay on Friday. This is the harshest punishment ever handed down for an on-field incident at the World Cup, but it was his third time biting a fellow player. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Saturday, June 28th. Welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
Our staff there has say the town of Bambari has been reduced to a ghost city. They say that Christian neighborhoods have been virtually emptied of residents from previous attacks, while displacement sites are packed.
Thousands flee from deadly attacks by various groups of armed men in the Central African Republic town of Bambari.
The announcement was very well received. I think that it will take some time for the importance of this to sink in, but certainly this is a big event. The United States for several years now has been undergoing a policy review.
The United States announces steps towards mine ban treaty accession.
A lot of people, when they think about growth in Africa, they think it's only driven by mineral wealth or oil-exporting countries. But what we find in our report is that even those countries that are not considered resource-rich are still growing effectively.
And international economists are optimistic about Africa's economy, saying the continent may get a best growth rate since the global economic recession in 2009. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of people have fled this week from deadly attacks by various groups of armed men in the Central African Republic town of Bambari. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Tensions have been at a boiling point in Bambari since May, when widespread fighting displaced more than 13,000 people. On Monday, armed elements attacked a Muslim displacement camp south of the city. Other armed men and the civilian population then retaliated. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says at least 45 people have been killed and scores wounded in the attacks and counterattacks. She says the violence has prompted thousands of people to flee the town, which lies about 380 kilometers northeast of Bangui, the capital of CAR.
Our staff there has say the town of Bambari has been reduced to a ghost city. They say that Christian neighborhoods have been virtually emptied of residents from previous attacks, while displacement sites are packed with people struggling to get by. And of course, to compound it all, we have the rainy season making things even more miserable.
Fleming says people urgently need better protection, shelter, water and sanitation, as well as food and other items. She says the UNHCR and its partners are doing their best to fulfill these needs, but the volatile security situation is making it difficult to operate. She says the delivery of humanitarian assistance is also being hampered by fears that the cycle of revenge attacks soon will pick up again. In addition to internal displacement, Fleming tells VOA, more people continue to flee into neighboring countries.
We're seeing that the conditions of people coming in are just absolutely despicable. I mean, in terms of human frailty, what is being done to them, people with machete wounds, huge numbers of malnourished. This we've been reporting to you for the past several months, and it continues. So a reflection of a really just horrific situation inside the Central African Republic, where the state is not in control and where the fighting continues unabated.
The latest UNHCR figures show nearly 140,000 people from CAR have sought refuge in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Chad, and the Republic of Congo in the last 6 months. It says most of the refugees are in Cameroon, where last week the UNHCR registered another 3,000 people. The agency says the number displaced inside Central African Republic is even higher. 536,500 people. More than 111,000 of them are living in 43 sites in Bangui. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The third review conference of the Mine Ban Treaty ended Friday in the Mozambican capital Maputo. During the conference, the Maputo Action Plan was adopted, providing a roadmap for what needs to happen during the next 5 years to achieve a world without landmines. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines, ICBL, is a global network in some 100 countries that works for a world free of anti-personnel landmines. Jared Block is the organization's media and communications manager. I reached him by phone in Maputo immediately after the conference to find out the highlights.
The third review conference of the Mine Ban Treaty was a chance for member states and some observer states as well to the Mine Ban Treaty to review progress to date over the past 15 years since the Mine Ban Treaty came into force, and to look at the challenges that still remain. So many successes to be celebrated here in Mozambique. First of all, Mozambique itself is a success story over the past 15 years. Mozambique joined in 1999, and in 2014, by the end of this year, it's expected that Mozambique is going to be free of landmines. This is following a civil war that left a legacy of landmine contamination throughout the country. So this is a huge victory for Mozambique, for Africa, and for the Mine Ban Treaty, and for landmine survivors.
And we understand the United States announced that it intends to join the Mine Ban Treaty in the future.
What the United States announced today is they are looking at taking down the barriers to future accession. So yes, they said that they are working on coming up with solutions, pursuing solutions that would allow the country to accede to the treaty in the future. That is what they said. That address was delivered by the ambassador to Mozambique from the United States today at the third review conference here in Maputo.
And how was that announcement received? Did the conference take it as being far enough for the U.S. to join this treaty?
Really, the announcement was very well received. I think that it will take some time for the importance of this to sink in, but certainly this is a big event. The United States for several years now has been undergoing a policy review. It's not been clear at all would be a positive stance towards joining the Mine Ban Treaty at all. So the fact that they've said that they're taking steps to solve barriers to joining in the future is a very big deal. Of course, U.S. is one of the has one of the largest stockpiles of anti-personnel mines in the world. So this is a big deal. It really sends a clear message to the international community that landmines are universally condemned, even by states that are not part of the Mine Ban Treaty, that this weapon really has been forsaken by most of the countries in the world. Today there are 161 countries on board the treaty. We expect Oman to be the next country to join the Mine Ban Treaty. It's announced its intentions to do so, which would bring it to 162 in the near future.
What would you say to the participation of countries that are not party to the treaty, including U.S., China, and India, attending this third review conference?
Indeed, from our perspective, that can only be a positive thing. The part of the provisions of the Mine Ban Treaty state that member states should promote the Mine Ban Treaty amongst their international partners, if you will, amongst the international community. So it is fully expected, appreciated, and encouraged that states that are not party to the Mine Ban Treaty would come to learn about the treaty, or in fact to get more information about how they themselves can join this treaty. This is a very positive thing when states not parties participate in the meeting of states parties.
That was Jared Block, ICBL's media and communications manager. He spoke with us from Maputo. Peace and security are prerequisites for the sustainable development of environmental resources as well as gender equality. That's according to the Vice President of Iran, who has been in Nairobi, Kenya, to attend the opening meeting of the United Nations Environmental Assembly, UNEA. UNEA is a new body which is aimed at putting global environment challenges under an international spotlight. UN Radio's Monica Grayley asked Vice President Mesu Ebuteka about the correlation between peace and security with the environment and gender equality.
I think that an important issue that we sometimes tend to overlook in the process of sustainable development, as well as in the process of the advancement of women, is the issue of peace and security. Currently, we're developing the sustainable development goals. This is a step forward. I think a major element which needs to be strongly emphasized is the fact that peace and security are the prerequisites, the basic pillars of sustainable development. Without peace, without security in a society, you cannot speak about enhancing environmental standards, nor can you speak about protecting women's rights or advancing their rights in that society. So we need to deal with these issues in a serious manner, because when speaking about the United Nations, the first mandate given to the United Nations is to protect peace on Earth. And the fact that today in many parts of the world, either war, aggression, or ethnic strife, different forms of violence, terrorism against women, and even different forms of crime against wildlife, against forests and timber, these are all issues that are plaguing our societies. Women have an important role in peacemaking and bringing human societies together. They tend to have the capability to touch the hearts and minds of their societies. And that's probably in part due to the spirit of motherhood that women have.
Dr. Masume Ebtekar, you are also the head of the Department of Environment. What does Iran expect from the outcome of this assembly?
We hope that the outcome would be a stronger emphasis on the need for global efforts from all sides, both developing countries and developed countries. I hope that developed countries will play their role in improving the state of the global environment. I think that they have an important share, both a historical responsibility and a share today in today's world in terms of the technologies, in terms of the peace-building roles that they can play, in terms of the fact that we need to strike that balance between the North and the South in today's world. That is a prerequisite, not only for protection of our global environment, but also for peace and security, also for gender equality in today's world. So I expect that that happens in this event. I think that the UNEA is an important step forward. We are now seeing the realization of many of our aspirations in that respect, but we still have a long way ahead.
That was Masumi Abtekal, the Vice President of Iran, who has been in Nairobi, Kenya, to attend the opening meeting of the United Nations Environmental Assembly. She spoke with UN Radio's Monica Grayley. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met Saturday with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta at the State House in Nairobi. The Secretary General thanked the President and the Kenyan government and people for hosting one of the four UN headquarters, and he expressed special appreciation for the President's participation in the first UN Environmental Assembly held in Nairobi with the participation of 163 member states. The Secretary General also expressed his solidarity with the people of Kenya in light of recent terrorist incidents. He expressed his confidence in the President's leadership in maintaining Kenya's unity in the face of the security challenges and offered support of the UN. The two leaders also discussed issues of regional peace and security, including the situations in Somalia and in southern Sudan.
First, I think foreign governments issuing advisories to their own citizens have a right to do so. For us, we do not believe that friendly governments should be issuing advisories. We believe foreign governments, friendly governments should be discussing with us, availing to us intelligence that leads them to the conclusions that they reach, so that we can take actions together that prevent attacks. As you remember, in the wake of 9/11 in New York, President George Bush said that either governments are with him or they are against him, and most of us stood with him because we believe that you've got to stand up against terror. So we don't believe that when we come under attack, these governments that we have stood with when they have been under attack should kind of be issuing advisories. That's not what we did when they have faced a similar problem.
Kenya's presidential spokesperson says President Uhuru Kenyatta's government has reassured tourists that the country is safe after some Western embassies issued travel warnings to their citizens not to travel to the East African nation. Manoa Espisu tells reporter Peter Klote that the government has redoubled security efforts to ensure the country's peace and stability.
First, I think foreign governments issuing advisories to their own citizens have a right to do so. For us, we do not believe that friendly governments should be issuing advisories. We believe foreign governments, friendly governments should be discussing with us, availing to us intelligence that leads them to the conclusions that they reach so that we can take actions together that prevent attacks. As you remember, in the wake of 9/11 in New York, President George Bush said that either governments are with him or they are against him, and most of us stood with him because we believe that you've got to stand up against terror. So we don't believe that when we come under attack, these governments that we have stood with when they have been under attack should kind of be issuing advisories. That's not what we did when they have faced similar problems.
There's a Soccer World Cup going. A lot of Kenyans are gathering in places and watching and enjoying the World Cup in Brazil. This, some experts say, presents soft targets to some of these terrorist organizations to attack. How is the government dealing with this?
In most cases, security has been beefed up around the cities. We encourage people to watch games from their own homes, but obviously hundreds, if not thousands, of fans are watching these games from public amenities, and we're working with owners just to make sure that the levels of security are enhanced, that people coming into pubs, for instance, are screened and such, so that people aren't carrying funny-looking, suspicious-type bags or stuff like that into these places. But also we're carrying out a public awareness campaign on terror and the fact that we shouldn't ignore suspicious things that we come across. And I think we believe that this is this particular campaign is going well.
So how about the public engagement as well as citizens' participation in cooperating with security agencies as part of an effort to combat some of these potential threats?
I think citizen engagement is part of that public awareness campaign we're carrying out, and it's been done in newspapers and radio and television and online. We believe that citizens are quite alive to the fact that terror is with us and is and that threat is persistent. We are working with our citizens. We keep these messages alive so that everyone does understand that whereas we are doing the best we can to make them safe, the question of security starts with every individual. Government can do what government needs to do, but every individual must be aware of whatever is in their surrounding.
That was Manoa Espisu, Kenya's presidential spokesperson. He spoke with reporter Peter Klote from Nairobi. This is Netline Africa. We're coming to you live from Washington. And now, next story is international economists are optimistic about Africa's economy. They say the continent will grow up to 5% or 6% over the next 2 years, its best growth rate since the global economic recession in 2009. Part of the success is attributed to growing South-to-South trade, prudent economic policies that are attracting investment, and increasing trade among African nations. The findings are included in this year's African Economic Outlook, released by the African Development Bank, the United Nations Development Programme, and the OECD Development Centre. And from Washington, reporter William Eagle has the full story.
Good news for Africa, say the experts. Growth is healthy and broad-based, fueled in part by infrastructure spending, domestic demand, and trade. Angela Lusigi is an economist and policy advisor for the Regional Bureau for Africa in the United Nations Development Program.
A lot of people, when they think about growth in Africa, they think it's only driven by mineral wealth or oil-exporting countries. But what we find in our report is that even those countries that are not considered resource-rich are still growing effectively. And this is mainly because of their agricultural sector, but also growth in services and a little bit of growth in manufacturing.
The report found that Africa's main foreign commercial partner is Europe, which accounted for nearly 40% of African trade, while 25% was with Asia and about 12% with North America. This year's African Economic Outlook notes that African countries traded $81 million worth of goods among themselves in 2012, and that such trade is growing faster than the continent's exports to the rest of the world. In the decade ending in 2010, inter-African trade experienced over 13% annual growth. Much of that trade is in light manufacturing of such goods as textiles, clothing, leather, building material, farm implements, and wood products. Lusigi says there's also strong domestic demand for manufactured goods, including television sets, phones, and other mobile technology. She says many of these products can be made in Africa. According to the report, two regions, East and West Africa, are leading the economic expansion with over 6% growth. The report attributes growth in part to lower inflation, particularly in energy and food prices, and to prudent macroeconomic policies by African nations. They include efforts to reduce deficits by cutting spending or limiting its growth and improving tax collection.
Well, I think one of the things that the report says, and the underlying macroeconomic framework is in place, and a lot of countries have balanced their budgets, they're not having unsustainable debt. They're managing the exchange rate. And right now, a lot of countries are putting a lot of focus in borrowing to invest in infrastructure. And this is happening not just for oil exporting countries, but even countries that are not considered resource rich. So as far as the macroeconomic policies and frameworks goes, there's been a lot of change in the last couple of years such that we now have a framework where, broadly speaking, a lot of countries are managing quite well. And the difference now, the next step is saying, how do we translate this stable macroeconomic framework into inclusive growth that touches the lives of people? Because one of the things that we are seeing is that there's a lot of inequality still. So as much as we're talking about growth, we have to see how that growth can impact all people and not just one group of people.
The report says external inflows of cash to Africa have remained stable or are growing. Official Development Assistance, ODA, estimated to be about $55 billion, remains an important lifeline for poor countries that lack sufficient foreign direct investment. Remittances from Africans abroad have remained healthy. They have rebounded since the economic downturn in 2009 and are expected to reach about $67 billion this year. Remittances are now the largest single external flow of funds to the continent and an important contributor to education and healthcare expenses. Following close behind revenues from remittances is foreign direct investment, currently at nearly $40 billion U.S. dollars. The report predicts that with sustained interest by investors in manufacturing and services, FDI could be more than $54 billion over the next 3 years. The report says a decade of strong growth has reduced poverty in sub-Saharan Africa, with the number of people living on less than $1.25 per day falling from nearly 60% to just below 50%. Continued growth, it says, depends upon the ability of countries to participate in so-called global value chains, as South Africa has done with manufacturing car parts. It also depends on creating an environment that attracts investors and a workforce with the skills that contribute to global manufacturing. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent, and then a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. But now let's start off with our Saturday music spot, and for that, just ask you to sit down, relax, and enjoy the music.
Madala, step ku step nga tambuka, hey, kame se tambula, omanye ngeri je tweisa, kaligwera meyo, muga katonda, poluke dele tubala, mulavu nge tungo ya goya, Kasoli mbacha tena na ye Mame ngo ya goya Sikuli mbe ngo ya goya Limu katwe ngo ya goya Nakulandi wa malonyo Ono ya mpo nye chalo Uma nye vinye watavi woma Gabi ya mpuru mbuse Nebo vikube noga Muli oulira tebitambula Sawa kwa tano labo mukate wabula mulido Yato lia injini, teri manyama yengo Woma nyivo mkwata, evi omu kwa noto vipapira Mazi gansuwa, evi omu kwa no mpola mpola Mama mpola mpola tukigi Sikuli mande mkatumula, umu kwa nengo ya goya Sikuli mengo ya goya, di mkatuengo ya goya Chumacha kasoli mbacha tena na ye Mamengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Limu katwengo ya goya Sikuli mbengo ya goya Oh, nasala wo Ya mkwata ni mkwata lafu Ya mfunza funza musonda Setu kaya chipoli Eno lafu, etamanya tioline chitiwa Mfuga vya chila lulavu, zintide walai yeah. Lavu, enzime amaso ngomze Sikuli mbande mukatumu lavu, mukwane ngo ya goya Sikuli mbe ngo ya goya, hey, mukatwe ngo ya goya Chumba cha kasoli mbacha tena na ye Mame ngo ya goya Sikuli mbe ngo ya goya Ndimu katwe ngo ya goya Sikuli mba ndimu katu mulavu Mukwane ngo ya goya Sikuli mbe ngo ya goya Ndimu katwe ngo ya goya Chumba cha kasoli mbacha tena na ye Mame ngo ya goya Sikuli mbe ngo ya goya Ndimu katwe ngo ya goya
Bongo brasa malo bimbo Chacun sa vie, l'hypocrisie, la jalousie, qu'on sort, j'en ai pas envie. L'amour et la haine, la vente de père, la haine et l'amour, quel duo d'enfer. Un sans l'autre, sans l'une ou l'autre, on ne peut l'être. L'autre là, l'autre là, à quoi ça sert? Tout ce que l'on perd, il n'y a rien à faire. La terre est mon repère. L'autre là, signé mon pas. Laurent Lorenzo, ouais. Yamaloyo, yaka bena litaka. Toko motale na makambango bena likolo. Ah, Oda motemona. Petit nanda sai sai fisto. Oka mokodi moko. Martin écran, l'écran géant.
Oui, maman, y'a ma Jojo, signore. Si tu vas les gars, y'a ma Jojo, Eric et
Walter Mounianya.
Y'a ma Jojo, Nico et Vizida.
Edia Taba, on est ce maquillage du papa Jonathan.
On commence à faire la fête, son homme.
Sortina, nos séries, si coca, tu sais balayer. Follow back à ma mère, gando. Bayaka fleur d'amour, Gofen Kanga.
Yeah.
wanga bien. Jacques Renard, Taki, Takis, Apataki, applaudissez très fort pour moi dans ce moment, dans ce moment, dans ce moment. Applaudissez Patricia Apataki. Allez, 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 Yaka, 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 moi, Yaka. Il est fort, yeah, ah, yeah. Pas bien, ouais, bêta, j'ai bien.
Ha, ha, attitude, attitude. Am I my record? Am I my baby? Super 15, super 15, super 15, super 15, ha. Yo, Black, you ready? Yo, Black, you ready? Yo, Black, you ready? Hello. Me a bad man. Me, I'm so dope, not a rag, man. You talking nonsense, you a nag, man. Just not come around, not a fag, man. Not a fag, man. Cause me sexy, not a fat, man. Me so fly, Batman. Me always good, and you feeling sad, man. Keep hating, I'm glad, man.
I like what I'm seeing. I like what I'm feeling. Baby, dance and touch the ceiling. Baby, give it to me, I'm willing. My phone, I like what I got. Girl, I like your swagger. I'm red on Tata. I'm red on Mama Soja. Soja, let go. Boy, I do the Azonto, Azonto.
Yes, that was our Saturday News Sport. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Here is Dr. Yang.
Hello, Africa. This week, I am particularly interested in the summit. I have been talking about the summit. Now what I want to look at how the forthcoming summit is going to affect the Obama legacy. There are many scholars who are beginning to look at President Obama in light of legacies. So when you talk about legacies, you pay close attention to the legacies of those before him. We can look at FDR and his contribution to the understanding of the presidency in this country. FDR is now remembered by many Americans in light of the Depression and how he got America out of the Depression. And, of course, he enjoyed the distinction of being the only American president who was elected more than the usual two times. He almost went four times, but he died in office to be succeeded by Truman. So if you go back to George Washington, who was dead at age 67, and John Adams at 92, and then Jefferson, 83, years old. And then you come on to succeeding generation of presidents to the point that you have Teddy Roosevelt, who was the youngest American president. The only one who came close to him was John Kennedy. Now, if you look at all of these people, they left their legacy. Let's go back to George Washington and see what are the lessons of George Washington for President Obama. Number one, he has been the most successful leader, in my opinion, who knew the benefit of term limits. He served for two terms, then he told the Americans, bye-bye, I'm going, guys, and he left. And then became the president until Teddy Roosevelt, who came, who wanted to go beyond the term limits. He failed. And, of course, his nephew-in-law, FDR, would be able to get closer to the point Teddy Roosevelt wanted to do. So if you're looking at legacies of presidents, George Washington not only gave a farewell address where he warned the nation not to engage in foreign entanglements, And those who came after him, Adams, he served for one term, and he was able to leave office to Jefferson, and he also created a game spirit. It was not well developed. He ran out of town when he lost without handing over. Historians can remember now that it was Jefferson's cousin, who was the Chief Justice, who handed over, and that became the legacy. From that time on, that the Chief Justice is the one who is the mediator between the one who is leaving office and the one taking on. President Obama witnessed this phenomenon when George Bush was handing over to him, and of course, that's part of legacy, legacy, legacy. So when you look at more immediate legacies, we have Monroe, who studied the Monroe Doctrine, which was a very important part of American historical development, and his legacy, if you remember that, the Monroe Doctrine. Now, when you come back to more recent presidents, what do you learn about legacies? Some of my colleagues at other universities who are looking at it have come up with some interesting suggestions. Some have suggested for him to look at more recent people like Truman, who also created a president. He succeeded as president, but he accepted that the odds were against him and he left. And his legacy was followed by LBJ. When LBJ succeeded from Kennedy, but then he won. But then when it was time for him to have a second term, he faced the same problem as Truman, and he learned from the Truman legacy. So both of them left a legacy. The buck stops here. It's still remembered by most Americans, Republican or Democrat, going back to the legacy of a senator who was not well known at the time when he was elected, because FDR changed vice presidents. And, of course, Truman was the last one, and he was the one who inherited power from him. So when we talk about legacies, we have the legacy of Kennedy, who didn't have even a completed one term, but he left the Peace Corps, and the Peace Corps is still here. And President Obama benefited from that legacy because his own father benefited from the great airlift done by Tom Boyer in concert with the Kennedys. That's legacy, legacy, legacy from the Kennedys. Then you go back to the legacy of LBJ as a Democrat. He left the Great Society. He made Americans sensitive to the problem of poverty, poverty, poverty. And then, of course, in more recent times, Bill Clinton's legacy is so relevant. He was able to get two terms since the days of Truman. He was able to get two terms. So this is one legacy Obama shares with Bill Clinton. Both of them got reelected. Jimmy Carter, unfortunately, has his legacy too. He proved to Obama that you can be very successful, even if you left office unsuccessfully, as he was defeated by Reagan. But Obama can also learn from Reagan, because Reagan was the oldest president for the United States. And Obama belongs to the younger generation like Bill Clinton, Kennedy, JFK, as President of the United States. So when we look at Obama's legacy, what some of the scholars are going to say, why don't you go back and look at Eisenhower, who affected our highway system? He led America in World War II. And so what the Nazis were doing with the Autobahn, he came here. Today you can drive on 81 all the way to California through the legacies of Eisenhower. Eisenhower also warned us to be very careful about the military-industrial complex. So if you're an African and you don't know much about America, but you are looking at America's legacy for Obama, for all of us here, and for all of you on the other side of the Atlantic, try to figure out the legacies of Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, the legacies of Nyerere, Leopold Senghor and others, and whether they learn anything from the American experience. And that's the way it is today.
That commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the team here at Nightline Africa, I thank you for joining us tonight. And have a good evening. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a closely watched election, seen as a test of civilian rule, voters in Ekiti State, Nigeria, have chosen Dr. Ayo Fayose as their next governor. With a heavy turnout on June 21st, Dr. Fayose received more than 203,000 votes, topping the incumbent, Dr. Kayode Fayeme, who received some 120,000. Dr. Fayeme quickly conceded the results, setting the stage for a smooth transition of power when the new governor takes office in October. In a democracy, the people choose their leaders, making their voices heard on election day. In a democracy, leaders put the public interest above their own and heed the voices heard at the polls. The United States commends Governor Fayeme on graciously accepting the election results. "Election must not be seen as a do-or-die affair," he said. "I believe we must build this democracy to a mature end rather than pull it down. We urge all parties to accept the outcome in the same spirit, as representing the will of Ekiti's voting public." Nigeria's democratic system will be further tested in the months ahead. Voters in the southwest Nigerian state of Osun go to the polls in another off-cycle gubernatorial election on August 9th, and in February 2015, the nation will pick its next president during general elections. The voting in Ekiti should lend confidence to the Nigerian public and international community that the nation's independent National Electoral Commission, security forces, and the political parties have the capacity to conduct themselves in a manner that strengthens Nigeria's democracy and gives political voice to its population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.